Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. It's been another of those weeks when my work has prevented me from pursuing any in-person interviews out in the community, though I do plan to attend a demonstration on Monday, September 18th at the Ohio Department of Natural Resources at 9:30 a.m. on Morse Road. It is to urge the ODNR to reject proposals from the oil and gas industry to begin fracking in two of our state parks. One of those is the Salt Fork State Park near Cambridge, Ohio, which I visited a couple of times. Fracking was not previously allowed in state parks, but the Republican, gerrymandered, Ohio legislature recently passed a law stripping our state parks of that protection by making them eligible for mining and drilling leases. The Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which is usually an industry ally, must review applications, and there is a mandatory public comment period, which is happening right now. I'm sure you got a letter in the mail or read an announcement in your local paper, right? This comes as protesters in Appalachia have been getting arrested and charged with various crimes for staging nonviolent civil disobedience actions to stop the construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. The two issues, fracking and the pipeline, are obviously related, but not always connected in the public's awareness. Well, today we have an interesting presentation on another underreported relationship between two parallel crises in today's modern world, climate change and human migration. We've seen catastrophic flooding in Libya after an unusually heavy rain driven by climate change. Thousands of people have died in that disaster just last week. But climate change isn't creating more volatility in the weather. It's rendering some parts of the planet literally uninhabitable. And that, by necessity, is driving waves of migration mostly to the global north. Many northern countries are struggling to cope with the influx of refugees, and that crisis is steadily intensifying. Yet it is the northern industrial countries that are the principal drivers of climate change, not the nations of the global south that are disproportionately affected. In today's show, we have a lecture from Abram Musgarden speaking recently at a university in Maine.
I'd like to now introduce the 2023 Linda Cotter Speaker Series speaker, Abram Musgarden. Abram is, at his core, an investigative journalist who focuses on the environment. His work on climate change, the economy, and human migration are excellent, and I encourage you to look them up if you have not done so already. Abram is a graduate of Cornell and Columbia Universities. This isn't his first trip to Maine, and we hope to see him again in central Maine. He is an internationally known writer and reporter for ProPublica, the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic Magazine, and PBS Frontline. His work has appeared in Scientific America, Wired, Salon, Esquire, and The Washington Post, among other publications. We are very honored to have him as our speaker tonight. Please welcome Abram Musgarden.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Got to get my notes back to the top. All right. Thank you, everyone. It's really wonderful to be here. It's an honor to be invited. And thank you to the Mid-Maine Global Forum and to the Goldfarb Center for its interest in this issue. Really pleased to be able to talk about it. Migration is something I believe is so important to the future balance and stability of the world. I've come to care a lot about it through my work and my reporting. I think the future of human migration is one of the most consequential aspects of the issue of climate change. So to get there and to get into our conversation tonight, I want to start with the past, very far back in the past. Because I think it gives a little perspective about the things that you're about to hear and puts the change that we're living through in that historical context. So moving, it turns out, is the ultimate form of climate adaptation. Somewhere between 60,000 and 80,000 years ago, told you, far back, the earliest Homo sapiens fled Africa because of drought, and they chased the bounty of a green belt of vegetation northward. And they made it as far as the Middle East, mixing for a few thousand years with the Neanderthals before extreme climate shifts drove those Neanderthals to extinction. As the Ice Age lowered sea levels, the surviving humans then walked across exposed land bridges south across what are now the islands of Indonesia, perhaps sailing short distances to New Guinea before walking onward to Australia. Only later, with the retreat of those glaciers exposing verdant northern latitudes, could people settle on the European continent and beyond. And such has been the role of the environment in shaping where people live on the planet for all of the ages since. Sorry. 3,000 years ago, the Indus Valley emptied out because of drought. Some anthropologists believe that 1,100 years ago, Mayan civilization crumbled because of water shortages. 900 years ago, Chinese herders moved 1,000 miles northward into the Russian tundra, seeking new pastures as the northern plains of Asia thawed. Ever since, humans have been driven across continents by ambition, by persecution, by aggression, curiosity, and evangelism, but looming larger than perhaps anything else were the changes in their climate. So about 4 years ago, I set out on a project to understand how the changing climate today will again lead the population of the planet to reorganize and to migrate, and to understand the far-reaching implications for stability and for society. This was a project that would eventually wind up as a three-part series in the New York Times Magazine and is now the subject of a book that I've written that comes out early next year. And I travel through Central America, through Mexico, and the American South, reporting in rural regions and tagging along with the United Nations and with their World Food Program. We hired researchers who had first built migration models for the World Bank to build new models for us, forecasting rates of human migration in response to climate change. We tried to build on the academic research body and sharpen a more precise picture of what was to come. Future migration is different than what's happened in the past because the world is different. The transformation of the planet's environment today is unlike anything in history. So this is a picture that represents the average global land temperature by year, starting in the early 1800s into the present, with red showing the degree of anomaly from that historical average. The changes are more extreme, and they're unfolding more quickly. And at the same time, the number of people affected, the number of people on the planet, is vastly larger than any other previous point in the world's change. Consider, for example, that when the Mayans were thought to have succumbed to drought around AD 900, the planet's total population was just 226 million people. By the time scientists began warning in earnest of climate change, the mid-1970s, the world's population had swelled to 4 billion. Since then, the number of people has doubled again, nearly 8 billion, or I think we just surpassed 8 billion, now inhabit the Earth. By 2070, the world's population could be somewhere between 9 and 12 billion people, depending on the policies that are put in place at this point. All the while, even with the change already baked in, the Earth will continue to warm. My central question was this: could better understanding climate-driven migration's role in conflict and in current events help us plan better for the future? And at the heart of my interest was a conviction that as the planet slowly cooks, people will do what they have always done for thousands of years in response to changes in their environment. They will move. The first big question, then, is how many people? And to answer that, we have to consider how many people will be most negatively affected by climate change. It turns out that there is an optimal climate zone for human life, a climate niche. For the past 6,000 years, humans have gravitated towards a narrow range of temperature and precipitation that supported agriculture and later supported economic growth. But now that niche is shifting towards the poles. According to researchers who published this research in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences in 2020, the change that we're seeing now is happening faster than at any point in the history that they've examined. Climate change is remapping, literally, where humans can exist on the planet. Historically, only a small sliver of the Earth's surface, just about 1%, was so hot that researchers described it as uninhabitable. But today, that sliver is fast expanding across some of the most crowded places on the planet. including the entire equatorial belt of the African continent, from the border of Morocco to the coast of Kenya, as well as all of South Asia and the near entirety of Brazil. By 2070, some 19% of the climate of the planet will be too hot. This change is well underway. Already, more than 600 million people have been stranded outside of the crucial environmental niche that best supports human life. Should the world continue on its present warming pathway, where we make political gestures at reducing emissions but don't meaningfully reduce global carbon levels, we will miss the Paris target by a long shot. The planet will likely warm not by 1.5 degrees, but by approximately 2.7 degrees Celsius on average. And that pathway could lead to 2 billion people falling outside of the climate niche within just the next 8 years. That's a moderate estimate. 3.7 billion people would fall out of the niche by 2090. So consider a worst-case projection. With 3.6 degrees of warming and a pessimistic climate scenario that includes ongoing fossil fuel use or little political response to emissions, the shifting climate niche would pose what the authors of that paper called, quote-unquote, an existential risk. It would directly affect half the projected total population, or as many as 6.5 billion people on Earth. Either way, the total number of people left outside of the climate niche will have grown between a third and a half of humanity by later this century. Climate change will pummel the poorer parts of the world disproportionately, effectively sentencing the people who live in developing nations and small island states to extreme temperatures, to failing crops, to conflict, to water and food scarcity, and rising mortality. According to the researchers' projections, India will have by far the greatest population outside of the climate niche. At current rates of warming, the researchers estimate that more than 600 million Indians will be affected. That's six times more than if the Paris targets were achieved. In Nigeria, more than 300 million citizens will be exposed, seven times more than if emissions were steeply cut. Indonesia could see 100 million people fall out of secure and predictable environment. In the Philippines and Pakistan, 80 million people each, and so on. Whole swaths of land in Brazil, in Australia, in India especially, would become less habitable. Many smaller countries might be nearly erased entirely, with all or nearly all of their land becoming unlivable. Burkina Faso, Mali, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Niger, among them. The U.S. faces far more modest impacts, but impacts nonetheless. The South and the Southwest will fall towards the hottest end of the climate niche, leading to higher mortality and driving internal migration here northward. This is what the shift looks like in the U.S. We took data from the climate niche research from the paper that I described and mapped it over North America for the purposes of my research. And you can see that optimum zone moves from about the lower Southeast and Appalachia right up to the Canadian border and the Great Lakes. Not everyone, of course, whose environment shifts even outside of this niche will migrate, but they all will face a choice. They can remain and endure that change in circumstance, or they can move. Most people, just from a purely mathematical standpoint, won't go anywhere, or they'll shift in small distances. But the sheer number of people affected suggests that even if a small fraction do, the change will be transformative. And this is how we get to what I think is coming next, which is the great human migration. In many parts of the world, this migration is already well underway. Climate pressures are already leading to upheaval, characterized by insecurity and food shortages and political and armed conflict. In North Central Africa, caravans of famished refugees have evacuated from the drought-racked shores of Lake Chad. In Bangladesh, flooding coastal deltas have sent a crush of people, first to the slums in Dhaka and then toward the Indian border. And in the United States, a quiet exodus away from the front lines of Western wildfires and the Gulf Coast hurricanes has hollowed out small towns. Perhaps no example is more telling than what happened in Syria. In eastern Syria, farmers faced a historic drought. Their animals died, erasing their livelihoods. And so many migrated to Syria's cities. They became impoverished in those cities, and eventually they joined the uprising against the government. And the rest, civil war, is a familiar history. Now, what happened in Syria was by no means a climate-exclusive event. Climate was just, and the environmental change was just one of many influences there. But the result, nonetheless, was millions of refugees fleeing in rubber rafts on the shores, to the shores of Turkey and to Greece, and ultimately on to Europe. You're going to hear about other situations later in this conversation about a familiar pattern. We start to recognize the same progression from displacement to economic strife or conflict to migration. The climate shocks don't have to be localized all the time either. A bad wheat crop in Russia in 2011 interrupted the export of grain to North Africa, causing food shortages that combined with high unemployment stoked the Arab Spring uprisings in Egypt and in Tunisia and Yemen and Libya. Together with the war in Serbia, these upheavals drove large waves of migrants to Europe in 2015, ultimately instigating or at least influencing the UK's exit from the European Union and causing plenty of political turmoil from Germany to Greece and Italy too. This just gives a sense of the scale and the reach of that refugee diaspora when an event like that occurs. Can we be sure that all of these situations are linked to climate change? Probably not. There's a large margin for error. But a 2017 study published in the journal Science examined the asylum applications of migrants to Europe from 103 countries, and they found a very distinct and clear correlation. As home climates worsened in the countries sending immigrants to Europe, those countries sent ever larger numbers of refugees. Now, as destabilizing as these waves of migration arguably have been, though, they were also relatively small. Combined, these conflicts brought just about 2 million people to the European continent between 2015 and 2017. And as you'll see with some of the numbers to come, we can expect that this is just the beginning, the subtle first signs of an epochal slow-motion exodus out of inhospitable places. So where will we see that upheaval first? The World Bank and academic researchers at places including Columbia University have begun to identify a number of hotspots around the world where they expect significant climate migration to emanate from in the future. One of those places where circumstances might be the most urgent is North Africa's Sahel. The band of nine countries sandwiched between the Sahara and the humid savanna is probably the most at risk of any region on the planet. More than 150 million people live there, and nearly half of them depend on subsistence farming to survive. Yet that land is quickly turning to desert. Its trees are cut down for fuel, and its soil is eroding from overuse and poor management. The drought here is among the worst in Africa, and already more than 100,000 people have died over the last several decades as access to water has decreased. At the same time, the population in the Sahel is growing faster than almost anywhere else on the planet, stretching those scarce resources even further. Each woman in the Sahel, on average, gives birth to about 5 children. Across northern Africa, the World Bank estimates that there could be 350 additional people by 2050, 350 million, excuse me. The known water supplies will fall far short for tens of millions of these people. The World Bank's chief climate economist laid this bare for me in very frank terms. "It really stretches the imagination to see how this can work," he told me. The bank's researchers expect migration to follow the same progression for how people have moved in the most vulnerable parts of the world in the past. First, migration begins in rural areas, which are often the poorest. They're dependent on fertile soil and abundant water, and these pastoral lands will begin to empty out. Most people, though, hope to remain as close to home as possible, and even when they decide, they must move. So first, perhaps, they'll jump to some mid-sized town in search of work and remaining close to family. Then, perhaps, they'll move to a capital city in what academics call a stepwise fashion. Only after that will they begin to move across borders and across continents. But that rural out-migration will drive a rapid urbanization that could quickly make cities dangerously overcrowded. The World Bank, for example, is sounding an alarm around the mind-bogglingly huge influx of people into East African cities like Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, where climate stress here is declining declining crop yields are driving people from the countryside into the city. The population here has doubled since 2000, and it's on track to double again by 2035. The bank predicts that as the climate worsens, some 57 million more North Africans will migrate within their own countries, searching for livable conditions. It's a pattern that'll be replicated on other continents, too. But then what? Right now, a little more than half the planet's population lives in urban areas. But by the middle of the century, the World Bank estimates that 67% of people will live in cities. Urbanization is a global phenomenon regardless of wealth, but it's the world's poorest people, the same people, continent by continent, whose ability to feed themselves is most affected by the climate crisis, who are the ones rushing out of rural areas fastest. In Africa, rural-to-urban migration, according to the World Economic Forum, is happening almost 11 times faster than it is in Europe. People move to cities because they can seem like a refuge. They have community, they have facilities, they have infrastructure. But they can just as easily become traps. Demand for water and electricity surges. And food, which increasingly needs to be imported, becomes more expensive. The costs drive the poor into slums, which suffer worst from the lack of clean water and sanitation. And they're dangerously built, and they're especially prone to flooding and other disasters. So the quality of life begins to spiral downward. As unemployment and poverty rise, so does human trafficking and domestic abuse. And as sanitation deteriorates, disease increases. This graphic shows the outpouring of rural regions into cities in Central America and Mexico, and it's based on some of the modeling projections and the data that I used in my reporting. So what happens next following this urbanization is what nations around the world seek to avoid most. Criminal groups become a substitute for government. Slums become hotbeds of extremism and chaos, ultimately fomenting conflict that can spill outward and destabilize whole regions. The recruiting and fundraising of Al-Qaeda, for example, has been linked to hardships in agriculture and animal grazing. By 2030, the World Bank estimates that 4 out of every 10 urban residents, or more than 2 billion people globally, will live in slums. And the International Committee of the Red Cross estimates that almost all of that growth, 96% of it, is expected in the world's most fragile cities, the ones that already face heightened risk of conflict. So here's how researchers from Columbia University and the United Nations put it to me. Societies affected by climate change may find themselves locked in a downward spiral of ecological degradation, towards the bottom of which social safety nets collapse while tensions and violence rise. As for Africa, it obviously sits adjacent to all of Europe, and the experts I spoke with fear the continent's climate-related losses will feed what one called a constant outpouring of people. It may be a very similar story in South Asia, though, which is also home to roughly 2 billion people. Oops. There we go. Himalayan glaciers are disappearing, and meltwater from the Himalayas, the water tower of Asia, supports the lives of nearly 1 in 4 people on the planet. The greatest rivers, the Indus, the Brahmaputra, the Ganges, the Yangtze, the Mekong, the Irrawaddy, the Salween, the Yellow River, they all run from these high glaciated peaks down to some of the world's largest cities. Just south of the mountains, a band of irrigation-dependent agriculture stretches for hundreds of miles into the lowlands of India and Bangladesh, of Myanmar and Vietnam and Thailand, making it possible to grow the food that feeds the continent. At the same time, temperatures there are skyrocketing, and the intensity and frequency of cyclones and flooding are increasing. So as the economies of the region have become increasingly unstable, some 8.5 million people have already fled that region. Tens of millions more have begun shifting about internally, moving from rural areas into the biggest cities, into Delhi, into Dhaka, and Lahore, and Karachi. The World Bank estimates that even under a relatively optimistic climate scenario, in which global carbon emissions are brought under some control, 17 million South Asians will be displaced within their countries due to increasing environmental stress. Under a bad case climate scenario, it projects 36 million people might leave their homes. The bank didn't even count the effects of rising seas in its models, though. Climate scientists have recently said they underestimated the number of people about to be displaced by rising tides globally by a factor of 3. They now estimate, and this is in the latest UN report, that between 150 and 630 million people globally will be forced from their homes as sea levels rise over the next 3 decades. This will inundate places like southern Iraq, places like eastern China, and the entire southern tier of the United States, or much of the southern tier of the United States. On the Mekong Delta, the livelihoods of about 20 million Laotians, Cambodians, Thais, and Vietnamese are in jeopardy as sea level rise threatens more than half of the land that they rely on for agriculture. That farming is essential, not just to the people living there, but to their broader national populations. In Vietnam, for instance, the farming of the Mekong Delta accounts for 24% of the country's GDP. It's the source of 90% of the country's rice exports, 70% of its fruit crop, 60% of its exported fish harvest. Now, coastal flooding will be an issue around the world, including in the U.S., but I want to bring you back for just a second to Africa, because here, too, we find one more devastating example, and that's in the agriculture-rich, low-lying Nile River Delta. The delta includes the cities of Alexandria and Cairo, which is just at the bottom of the dark triangle that you see there at the mouth of the Nile. More than 40 million people live and farm here, and they produce a significant portion of Egypt's food supply. And already, crop yields are falling fast with rising temperatures. But by later this century, one-third of the land there could be submerged, displacing about 10 million Egyptians. The third hotspot, though smaller by population, is Central America and Mexico. Those places will not escape the drama of warming either, and this is where I focused the bulk of my own research. So I arrived in El Salvador to conduct my own reporting in May of 2019. And over the next several months and several trips, I traveled north into Guatemala, into the border, across the border into Mexico, and traced the typical migration routes all the way up through Mexico to the U.S. border and the city of El Paso, Texas. In textbooks and reports, researchers described a clear mechanism for how large numbers of people move. They have computer models that simulate it mathematically in detail, but it becomes a very cold and analytical process. What I wanted to understand was how people make that decision to move and who exactly should be counted as a climate migrant. So about a week into my first trip into the region, I headed to the heart of Guatemala, to a state called Alta Verapaz. Alta Verapaz is an extremely vulnerable place. The region is a large, remote blade of land that reaches from the high mountains in Guatemala in the center of the country all the way down to near the Gulf of Mexico. And it's one of Guatemala's poorest and most populous places with 1.2 million people. The people here are mostly indigenous Mayan, and 90% of them live in moderate to extreme poverty. They farm as their main source of income and subsistence, and hunger is increasingly common as conditions become more difficult. 80% of the population here cannot always access sufficient food, and almost 1 out of 2 children show signs of stunted growth. In 2018, a starvation alert group affiliated with USAID ranked Alta Verapaz alongside Somalia as one of the most urgent famine risk places on the planet. The United Nations warns that temperatures here are rising faster than average and water resources are diminishing quicker. The swings between extremes and the intensity of storms are growing more pronounced than elsewhere in the world. And for much of the 5 years before my arrival, the dry corridor mountains, those are the high hills of Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador and Nicaragua, which lie in the rain shadow of western coastal ranges that capture the moisture that comes off the Pacific, they had seen virtually no summer precipitation at all. The future projections for these places are worse. Maize production in this part of Guatemala is forecast to decrease 14% just by 2050. Rice yields by 2070 could drop by nearly a third. And this is because areas of Guatemala that are now considered semi-arid, including Alta Verapaz, will soon be more akin to desert. Rainfall in arid parts of the country is expected to decrease by 60%, and groundwater recharge will drop by more than 83%. I arrived there in a village called Panzos. It's a loose grouping of wooden huts and primitive one-room houses with dirt floors, bright lights shining between the boards. Children sat around with visibly bloated bellies. Jerry cans of drinking water and gasoline were scattered around doorways where chickens and pigs walked freely in and out. We stopped our truck by a cluster of better constructed homes. These were the ones built from wooden boards nailed to a frame. And we were looking for two men that we knew through the World Food Program had led a local farming cooperative here. Eva Hernandez, which is who this is, greeted us in front of her house in an open space of beaten earth and compacted soil. Her family lived in a single room, enclosed by rough-hewn lumber boards capped by a rusted pallet of tin nailed to the roof. That tin trapped that burning heat and turned that room into an oven. Sharp stones and small boulders protruded from the floor. Against her wall, besides a full-size mattress, a wooden basin held an oily car battery, jury-rigged to charge her cell phone. Besides that were a couple dozen cobs of dried corn, maize that the family crushed, mixed with water, and used to make tortillas, which was, at that time, their only source of food. Eva, and later her husband Jorge, told me a story of hope. It was also a story of one failed effort to grow food after another. Jorge was the third generation in his family to work this land. His father was a Mayan farmer, had fought bloody battles to reclaim access to his ancestral fields from rich colonial landholders. They'd finally been allowed to lease it back on a rent-to-own basis, and Jorge was making good progress towards that purchase. He planted maize and beans on a flat section of silty soil that lay about a mile from the fast-moving currents of the Cajabon River, which flows down into the Gulf of Mexico. His crops were almost entirely for food, and he sold what was left over, for money to buy sugar, for bus fare, to send his kids to the government school. Though his fields were right there by the river, he had no irrigation to pipe and pump and distribute that water, and so they relied entirely on the rain. But in 2014, the spring rains failed to arrive. Meteorologists blamed it on the El Nino cycle, when the trade winds over the Pacific switch directions and pull moisture away from the American coasts. El Nino used to happen once or twice in a decade here, but it happened again in 2016 and again in 2017. In 2018, it finally did rain, but the timing was off. In the spring, Jorge's seeds were first scorched in arid heat, and then they were drowned by dousing downpours that followed. That fall, Jorge gambled his last seeds, trying to plant a second crop. And finally, that crop grew fruitfully. Then an unexpected flood came. Huge storms in the high mountains sent a flash flood roaring down the valley. Jorge and his 7-year-old son waded chest deep into water, searching in vain for a few juvenile cobs of corn that they could still pluck and eat. What had first seemed like bad luck was fast becoming a matter of life or death. His children, malnourished, had not grown taller or gained weight in more than a year. His options were limited. He'd already put a lien on his land for more seeds. The big corporate farms around him weren't hiring because of the drought. Men like him were getting robbed and killed when they took dangerous jobs in Guatemala City. The farm co-op that he was a member of pleaded with the Guatemalan agriculture officials for emergency aid. They just needed a few $1,000s to install that irrigation, but they were ignored. And so he pawned his last few assets, the motorbike, his father's animals among them, and he paid a guide or a coyote to help him travel to the United States. One night, just 2 weeks before I arrived, he gathered around the hut that I sat in with his entire extended family. They shed tears, traded hugs. The Mayan people are not accustomed to migrating for work the way people in so many other parts of Guatemala or Mexico are. Jorge packed his and his son's belongings in a small plastic grocery bag, and just before midnight, they left. So I want to just dwell here for one moment and underscore how excruciating and heartbreaking a decision this was for Jorge and for his family to make. I had expected, in going to this part of the world, to find something much more pragmatic. I expected a neat list of pros and cons, about an opportunistic decision, about prospective opportunities, and the people who thought they might find it in America. Instead, it was, by all accounts, a last resort. It was an attempt at mere survival. I heard similar stories up and down Central America. Fathers torn from their children, leaving land that they'd been attached to their entire lives, marriages slipping apart over late-night phone calls on disposable cell phones, while migrants face terrifying unknowns in big American cities like Houston or Los Angeles. Their migration was not pragmatic. It was an act of desperation. They had done everything in their power to stay. And by the time Jorge and his son left, or all of the others, there was no choice. Now, for others, the thing that ultimately forces them to leave might be several steps removed from the dying crops and the paralyzing heat. And yet, they are collateral damage from climate change just the same. And it raises questions about what defines a climate migrant. In San Salvador, I met a woman named Elvira de Jesus Cortez. Elvira was 22 when I met her, and she was working a job in the city cooking pupusas at a street-side food stand. She made about $7 a day, and her money went to pay rent and to buy baby formula. She ate at work because the food was free. And when she met me, the first thing she told me was that she wants to leave El Salvador, and she plans to get a housekeeping job in somewhere in Texas. But that would mean, and this was the hardest part of what she had to tell me, that she'd need to find someone immediately, maybe temporarily, to take care of her daughter. When American officials describe the reasons the Central American migrants are coming to the U.S. border, they point to gang violence and conflict as leading drivers that force people to move. And that's what U.S. immigration statistics or European immigration statistics say. All around the world, conflict, war, violence, they remain the largest factors affecting human migration. The Syrian example is textbook of that. But also, just like in Syria, the story is not always so simple. Elvira's husband was murdered by gangs in a small town in the mountains of El Salvador near the Guatemalan border. That's what forced her to move to San Salvador with her infant. And now street gangs force her to pay protection with her meager wages, and they routinely rob her apartment. So yes, Elvira is a victim of violence, and maybe she'll be driven out by that violence. But before she was a victim of violence, she was also a victim of environmental change. She moved away from the village that she grew up in after a climate-driven fungus wiped out the coffee crop and half of El Salvador's income from coffee with it. She says that she'd go back to that village today instead of leaving her daughter and emigrating to the U.S., except for the ongoing drought. And her family remains in that village, where they walk 30 or 35 minutes just to get fresh water, and where they are among the 44% of Salvadorans that the United Nations says has long lacked a steady and reliable source of food. So if Elvira leaves El Salvador, will she be a refugee fleeing violence or a climate migrant? Increasingly, the difference is blurring. So there we have it, excruciating last-ditch decisions and huge, unfathomable numbers, so large they may be difficult to comprehend. One half of humanity? The next question is, what can we do about it? Large-scale shifts in global populations will force difficult choices on the parts of government. They'll exacerbate social and political stress points, invariably threatening conflict. By the time I got to Mexico in my reporting, I saw this friction building in real time. Thousands of Central Americans were pouring across the southern Mexican border in the months that I was there. At the same time, U.S. policy from the north was pressuring Mexico to stop immigration. At first, Mexico was sympathetic to these migrants. They greeted them with open arms, and Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador expressed unconditional support. "We will take you all," he promised. But as those months wore on, the Mexican public lost patience, and they lost their empathy. The Mexican authorities began to crack down harshly, rounding up migrants at gunpoint. A few thousand were welcome. A few hundred thousand? Mexico was besieged, and it quickly led to rising nationalism and right-wing violence. And that's what's happened the world over and what is likely to continue. Syrian refugees come to Turkey, which attempts to pawn them off on Europe and on Greece. Hungary has fenced off its border from Serbia, part of nearly 1,000 kilometers of border walls surrounding EU states. India is completing a wall along the 2,500-mile-long border of Bangladesh. Building walls, keeping people out. Even in the U.S., this is what we're doing. This is the U.S.-Mexico border at the top and Lithuania-Belarus on the right. The choice whether to build walls or proverbially wells through aid is one of the fundamental choices we'll face going forward. As part of my research through ProPublica and the New York Times, and with some support from the Pulitzer Center, we ran our own models examining climate migration in Central America. We worked with the same demographers who worked with the World Bank. And sparing you all the intricacies of that process, the model suggests that the U.S. border could well see 30 million additional migrants over the next several decades. But more important than the numbers, the models looked at how policy changes immigration, or how policy changes migration. The models broke down the analysis following several socioeconomic scenarios that the UN now uses to understand the intersection between policy choices and climate emissions. And those scenarios lay out starkly different outcomes. A future in which emissions are slowed and geopolitics remain open, in which trade is robust and controlled immigration is welcomed, leads to more migrants coming to the U.S., but lower populations overall, globally, and less poverty and suffering, including in Guatemala. It suggests that greater global economic and geopolitical stability can be achieved. A more hostile future, according to the models, in which nations retreat behind walls, pursue more nationalistic policies, and are slower to reduce their emissions, that leads to faster population growth globally. It leads to deeper poverty, and increased famine. And ultimately, it suggests that vastly larger numbers of migrants will push against the U.S. border. Before we wrap up, I want to switch gears here for a moment, because it's worth noting that many countries in the North both stand to benefit in some ways as the climate warms, and because they're almost all facing demographic decline, will need a lot more people, perhaps immigrants, to seize on that opportunity. As a part of this reporting, the third part of my magazine project, I looked at this dynamic in Russia, which is one example of a potential strategic winner. There's two things about Russia. It has land and it needs people. And with warming, more of its frozen land is becoming more habitable and more useful. An influential Stanford University study estimated that Russia could see more than 400% growth in its per capita GDP as the climate warms. Russia is already capitalizing on the opportunity. Growing grain, it is, depending on the year, already the largest exporter of wheat globally. And with warming, it's implemented a number of domestic strategies, including using immigrants from the rest of Asia to make all of its land productive. In the Russian Far East, where this change is happening fastest, the region has another dynamic. It sits north of the second most populous country in the world, China. Chinese migrants are already spreading northward as thawing permafrost opens new farmland in eastern Russia, and the Chinese see new opportunities for growth there. The two countries have many strategic alliances, but they're all intertwined. Arms deals, for example, are in part conditioned on the Far East remaining open to these Chinese immigrants. And the two countries share an interest in opening shipping lanes from northern China through the Arctic. So it's not inconceivable to imagine a future where China's huge population begins to spread northward onto a thawing tundra. Elsewhere and around the world, the North will also do well. Canada could see its per capita GDP grow by 230%, according to the study, due to climate change. But it, too, needs people. The private sector in Canada is pushing what it calls the Century Initiative, and it's a plan to grow the population of Canada from 32 million people to 100 million people by later this century. So as a result, logically, Canada is welcoming many more migrants, and that's a recognition that human capital drives economic prosperity. So, everything we're talking about today suggests that climate-driven migration could easily eclipse even the largest estimates as enormous segments of the Earth's population seek safe havens. The same data that suggests that one-third of humanity could soon be excluded from the climate niche also makes a moral case for immediate and aggressive policies to slow down the rate of warming and to lower the number of people globally destined for greater suffering. What we do next makes a difference in terms of cutting emissions and in terms of policy. The world has already warmed by about 1.2 degrees Celsius on average, and that has pushed 9% of the Earth's population out of the climate niche. At 1.3 degrees, the research suggests the pace will pick up, and for every tenth of a degree of additional warming from here on out, 140 million more people will be pushed outside of that niche. The Paris Agreement has set a goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, but that now seems all but unrealistic. Scientists estimate that the pace of political change has us on target for 2 to 2.7 degrees of warming, and that might be optimistic. The science, on the other hand, is clear. Every ton of carbon dioxide cut directly translates to less heat. Slowing global emissions would dramatically reduce the number of people displaced or grappling with conditions outside of the climate niche. These were the key findings of the same researchers who identified that climate niche, and they published them in a follow-up study, a monumental study in Nature, just a few months ago. If warming were limited to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the Paris target range of warming, half as many people would be left outside of the optimal zone. Recall for a minute, if global emissions were held back in Nigeria, the number of people displaced from the climate niche would drop from 300 million to approximately 40 million people. The global population suffering from extreme heat would be reduced fivefold, from 22% to just 5% of the people on the planet. The moral case makes clear who should bear responsibility for that effort. Throughout the world, the climate niche researchers estimate the average person who's going to be exposed to unprecedented heat comes from a place that emitted less than half the per capita emissions as of those in wealthy countries, and one-fifth that of Americans. American per capita emissions are more than twice those of Europeans, who still live a prosperous and modern existence, so there would appear to be ample room for comfortable change short of substantial sacrifice. Each American today emits nearly enough emissions over their lifetime to push one Indian or one Nigerian of the future outside of their climate niche, the study found. And this makes clear exactly how much harm Americans' individual actions can cause. And this is the thought I want to leave you with today. What we do next matters. Regardless of policy differences on how to get there, we should now see clearly the stakes. If this summer's taught us anything, it is that. The steps to addressing them are well understood. They are doable. They rely on technology that already exists. We just need to take those steps, one and then the next, and keep going. Reducing consumption, for example, doesn't have to mean lowering our standard of living. It might just mean lessening waste or getting rid of inefficiencies. And achieving that would not only slow down the rate of warming, but it would reduce the number of people elsewhere who will suffer the consequences tomorrow. So with that, I'll finish up and look forward to your questions, and thank you so much for your attention this evening. And I'm also going to shamelessly plug my book, which if you have the patience to copy down the URL, you can find the, you know, the pre-purchase stuff.
Can I have one more round of applause for us? And already their hands up. I didn't even have a moment to sit down to say thank you very much to our speaker. So I imagine that you're all bubbling with questions, and I've been asked to indicate that there are microphones roaming around. So if you could ask your question directly into the microphone, because we are recording. So this is our moment to say something big, something powerful, something influential that could potentially change the world, right?
And it's my favorite part of the night, so bring it on.
All right, if I may, I'd like to ask the first question, and I've just been thinking about this very much. I want to know what brought you to this line of work. So if you could take us back a little bit before you started here, how did you get here?
To journalism or to climate change?
To climate migration.
I have an incredibly privileged existence at ProPublica, which if you're not familiar, it's a nonprofit devoted to investigative reporting that's willing to put an enormous amount of funding behind very in-depth projects. And so what that means for me is that I have the luxury of going very deeply into a subject and not publishing a story for a very long time that would probably get me fired at any other news outlet in the world, which lets me dive deep. And so that's one factor. And the other, you know, it was a brainstorming session. I mean, coming up with the idea was a collaboration between my editors at ProPublica, my editors at the Times, thinking about what we could do that would you know, what are the few largest issues around climate change? And you could say that that's biodiversity. You could say it's a number of other things. But one of them certainly is this notion that it was going to change where people live on the planet. And it really hadn't been touched in a meaningful way by, you know, the media that I look to for examples. And so it was an opening, and I was incredibly curious about it. And that was the beginning. And everything after that was just this long period of earning a, you know, symbolic PhD in the subject.
Those PhDs, right? All right, so let's have the first question. We have someone with a microphone.
Abram, I thought that at one point when you were speaking specifically of the United States, that some of the southern states would be within the niche and that some people would remain. And I don't understand, if there's no food, no crops, no water, how would they be able to remain?
In the southern United States?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think we'll get to that point in the southern United States, except maybe in the southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, southern California. It's really a different... The impact is a different order of magnitude. What Guatemalans will see, or the African Sahel, compared to what the United States will see, the impact will be great enough to disrupt everything that's familiar to us about what the United States is and where people live. But it won't be so disastrous that people cannot. I don't think anyway. It won't be so disastrous that people cannot live on that land, or that you know, they're literally expelled from it. You know, so what I take from that data is, you know, the difficulty of living in those southernmost regions is going to increase sharply, and it's going to increase more dramatically in certain places like the Southwest. But those places won't be entirely unlivable. In fact, I think that, you know, a lot of people will continue to live there. Unfortunately, what the models say is that the people who remain will be, you know, will be poorer than average, and older than average. So, you know, mobility corresponds directly to means. And if you have a young family and a professional life and professional opportunity in the places that you go, you're more likely to move. And for Americans in particular, that'll probably be a driving force that brings people out of the South and towards the Northeast on balance.
Okay, great first question. I think one of the takeaways from what I heard, at least, is just the variability across the planet, just so much variation, not only in the climate impacts, but also in the migration patterns. So definitely something to keep in mind. Right, second question.
Yeah, yes. I'd wonder if you'd just speak briefly to the general issue of resistance to change, particularly as it pertains to understanding the extent to which global climate change is a significant problem for us all.
I think somewhere in there is a political question.
Well, not just in the United States, but globally. Are there patterns that you see emerging?
You know, I think if we're talking about, you know, acceptance or embracing of the reality of climate change, I think it boils down to three things, or maybe I'm forgetting something, but we'll see. In no particular order, there's entrenched interests, which is a big factor. So there are, you know, there's a global economy that's based on the way things work now, that sees itself threatened by the proposition of changing the priorities of that economy, or the driving industries of that economy, or even the rates of consumption of that economy. So quite literally, as you've read in exposés about Exxon and, you know, and others, there are forces working against that adoption of, you know, of the reality of climate change. So that's one. A second, maybe I just have two here, but I think, you know, I think psychologically it's just hard to fathom the enormity of the change. And, you know, it's scary to think about. It takes time to think about. So, you know, relative to the wealth of a lot of other parts of the world, we have that luxury to think about it here in the United States. But other places, or poorer people in the United States especially, you know, are just trying to make ends meet. So that's a factor. And then the more you do think about climate change, the more overwhelming it can be. This was not an uplifting conversation. It's not a pleasant thing to spend, you know, all of your waking hours thinking about. And I think that, you know, that contributes to a propensity to just kind of go along with the status quo and The change is so slow that it's almost imperceptible in any given moment, and you can just ignore it quite easily for a long time.
A scale of, say, 1 to 10, how optimistic are you about or being able to handle this in the next generation or two, with 10 being, oh, yeah, it's a slam dunk, no problem?
I think it comes down to your definition of handle this. So the change is upon us. The scientific consensus is super clear that the change will be extraordinary. I really think that there is enormous opportunity to still mitigate how severe that change is, especially in the northern parts of the world. And so I wish nothing was changing. I'm saddened by the reality of it all, but I find some hope in the progress that's yet to be made. And I feel like I've learned that, as I said, that the progress is, the need to make it is so urgent that try to spend a little less time being depressed about it and more time just doing the next thing that needs to be done.
Right, thank you. Well, one word that I heard there that stood out to me was resistance. And one of the things that I've learned from my line of work is that resistance isn't always a bad thing. So have you seen any evidence of resistance that could be interpreted as a positive thing? Or has there been any resistance to move that we need to consider as we think about these issues? Well, we can think about it and take the third person.
I mean, I'll try to answer. I can't really think of an example of, if you mean resistance to like the reality of climate change, most of what I see around the world is, is a negative resistance to either a change in thinking or a literal change, in economies and habits that people just don't want to make. And then those intertwine a lot with a lot of other socioeconomic issues where there's other forms of resistance around, racial justice and economic justice, tax policy, relationships between governments. I don't see a lot of positive resistance in those examples either. I'm sorry to say.
No problem. Can I add one of my own?
Yeah.
But what I've seen a lot in small islands is that people just don't want to leave their homes because there is this genuine connection and deep connection to the land. So oftentimes when I present, I hear, why don't people just move? And my response is, it's always just a little bit more complicated than that. So we have to think about the nuance in these conversations. So something you can take with you.
Yeah.
All right, third person, thank you.
That was a lecture on climate change and its impact on global migration. Well, I've got to migrate to other tasks here as our time's up for this week, but you can catch the next edition of Conscious Voices next week at this time here on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP, now broadcasting at 91.9 FM. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, an informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner. So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course. Please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your community.